session number 17896, reel 4.
So how long did you spend in Oma?
About a year.
Mm-hmm. And then you were posted to the Canal Zone, is that right?
No, I went from Oma to Belfast, to our 6th Battalion. And I think I was there for about a year and a half, getting. We'd never had a battalion before, so we literally formed it from scratch. And we built up to a very big battalion, an awful lot of people who'd been in the war. I managed to get them to come back again among the officers and the men. And we had companies in we had two companies in Belfast, one in Ballymena, one in Larne, one to a place called Ballyclare, and one in Lisburn, which was our support company. And they trained two nights a week and three weekends a month.
Are you talking about territorial?
Yes, they were territorial, yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, this wasn't the regular battalion?
I was then, having been adjutant of a regular battalion,
yes.
They reckoned they needed a regular adjutant to start the TA battalion off, because there was nothing. I mean, my colonel was a regular, myself I was a regular, and the quartermaster a regular, all the rest were territorials.
Can you tell me a bit in detail about how the training of territorial battalions is organised? I mean, they're all ex-regulars, presumably.
There were some recruits who came in. Well, we just followed the normal army recruit syllabus for the chaps who'd never been in before. And the fellows who had been in before, the company commander made out his training program for them, and the colonel wrote a directive. That's really what it was. And he would say what standard he wanted to get to, and that we normally started at section training and then platoon training and then company training and then finally, there'd be battalion training. We'd have a battalion exercise somewhere in the north of Ireland. And this was a sort of cycle. And we ran NCOs carders for young chaps who were, you know, NCOs of the future. And there was officers training. And there were courses for all these chaps that they could do over on the mainland, you see. So we eventually trained them up to, well, I mean, you had the single platoon doing its specialized training that you would understand. We had the intelligence section. We had the different specialist platoon, medium machine gun, which in those days were Vickers, 3-inch mortars, which now would be 81 millimeter. And we had a pioneer platoon as well. My colonel decided that he would treat everyone, all right, okay, you were soldiers during the war, but you've been out for X number of months. I'm afraid we're going to go through it again, but we're not going to labour it as far as trained soldiers are concerned, but we are going to do training in those cycles, you know, section right up to battalion.
Of course, the way groups of soldiers are divided, you know, starting if you're like a division,
yes,
and then it goes down to brigade,
yes,
then battalion,
yes,
company,
yes,
and platoon,
yes, and then section.
And then section.
Yes.
Now, presumably you train in two ways. First of all, you train to be a section, do you? How you operate as a section.
That's right,
and then
yeah.
How you integrate yourself into larger and larger bundles.
That's right.
Now, that must be extremely complicated.
Not a bit.
It?
It's the most simple thing in the world.
Yes.
Because you start off with your individual skills. You get your weapon training right. You get your tactics at section level right. Fire and movement is the, you know, virtually in a section, it's the Bren group and it's the rifle group. It's as simple as that. You do your patrol formations, patrolling by day, patrolling by night. You do all your weapon training so that you can strip and assemble all weapons and that everyone can. And you fire every weapon. When you're at the section level, the only things you fire are the Bren gun and the rifle. And, of course, you in those days you used to do bayonet drill as well, bayonet fighting. And then when you get to your platoon, you've then got the platoon weapon, which was then the 2-inch mortar. And we had no replacement for the boys' anti-tank rifle, thank God. And then at company, you then get to the stage when your company support weapons would be the 3-inch mortar, as it then was, and the Vickers machine gun, whatever detachment. You see, I had a platoon of Vickers, and what normally would happen was that the CO would give a detachment of Vickers, of two guns, to each company and keep one in reserve. And really, those are the only weapons you had to worry about, and the pioneers had to train with explosives and with mine detecting. It's terribly simple, actually.
So I suppose you would be applied in different levels of strength according to the circumstance on the battlefield.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, for the big push, you'd attack in battalion strength. Or
yes, that's right.
Brigade,
yes, certainly, yes. Yeah.
Whereas for little infiltrations or night raids or intelligence exercises, it would be a company or...
Well, it might even be a section, you see. Yeah. If you're sending people out to find out information, you send out a reconnaissance patrol, which might be 4 or 5 men under an NCO. Or, depending on the importance, you might have an officer commanding and you might have the best part of a platoon with him.
How have weapons changed during your absence? I mean, when you came back, the Bren was still current, was it?
Yes,
it
the Bren...
It was current when I was there.
The Bren only went out. We got the general purpose machine gun, what they call the Jimpy, in about 1962. And we had it in Borneo. And we also had Brens. And actually, in the jungle, I found that the Bren was, because it was light and manoeuvrable, was a better weapon to carry. But I liked having the GPMG in my platoon and company bases there, because I also had Vickers there as well, which no one knew until I wrote my book, because I stole...
Was that the old water-cooled?
That's right.
World War One.
Yeah, I stole 6 while I was in Hong Kong and took them, and I trained up. I knew that I was going to have a pioneer platoon from the Malaysian army. I knew I was going to have a Gurkha pioneer platoon. So I turned my pioneer platoon into a Vickers machine gun platoon because one of my officers was a Vickers specialist. Some of my men were Vickers specialists. So I turned my defense platoon, into the Vickers platoon, and I turned my pioneer platoon into a rifle platoon. So by fiddling around, I borrowed a platoon from the Durham Light Infantry, who were then stationed in Hong Kong. They were going to miss Borneo, they thought at the time. So the CO, I said, you know, it'd be good active service for your chaps. So I formed an extra rifle company, you know, out of these people. But I'm waffling away. The Vickers was a most super gun.
Why?
Well, you had this incredible sustained rate of fire, and you could fire overhead fire. You see, you could fire over an obstacle, whereas the GPMG is direct fire. But you had the trajectory of a Vickers. I mean, I could fire over the crest of a hill onto a target. Also, it fired about 3,000 metres, you see. It's a hell of a distance, whereas the I don't know what the GPMG
it
does.
Heat a lot. Just have to keep
no,
it
well, you, well, you, that's right. Yeah, you see, again, the only time it would overheat was if you were in a hell of a battle, and then, of course, the hell of a battle, you'd probably be in a defensive position, in which case you would have water to, for it to top up with.
You didn't have
wonderful.
To keep changing overheated barrels.
No, like no, didn't change the barrel at all.
You didn't have to keep changing magazines?
You had a belt.
Yeah.
No, it was a super weapon.
Yeah.
I loved it.
And what was the rate of fire, say, compared to the Bren?
Don't ask me.
I mean, it was
much more, used much more ammunition. I've never been good on figures, I'm afraid, as I told you, my mathematics. Mm-hmm. I never could remember. I always reckon I'd got some experts who could say what I needed. I don't know what the hell the rate of fire was. But the rate of fire of a medium machine gun was definitely higher than a light machine gun. But I loved the Bren, in fact. The Bren was a great little weapon. The GPMG was much heavier. You had these enormous belts.
General purpose machine gun.
You can fire it off a tripod, or you fire it off a bipod, or you can fire it from the hip. Well, you could do that with a Bren as well.
Did you ever experience the stem?
I did indeed, yes. Very a very doubtful little weapon that, and you couldn't rely on it. I mean, I have two personal experiences of two accidental deaths with a Sten going off. One in Palestine and one in Borneo. as it were, not Borneo, one in Palestine and one in Egypt. Just a bloody Sten loaded, safe to catch on, given a bump, and off it went. I lost a very good corporal in Palestine called Corporal Penfold.
What about mobility? I remember as a child the noise of the Bren gun carrier. Did you have Bren gun carrier?
We had Bren gun carriers when I first joined. We didn't have them in Palestine. No, we didn't. We had nothing but jeeps in Palestine and three tonners, as they were called, and 1,500 weights. I think we'd 96 jeeps, but we'd no carriers. Mm. And we'd white scout cars then.
Yes. Were those the dingoes?
No, we had dingoes as well, now you mention it. No, the white scout car was an American thing, had about six wheels, if I remember.
I know.
Very good. Mm. Armoured.
Anyhow, you eventually went out to Egypt?
Yes.
Yes. To the canal zone?
Yes.
And that was another trouble spot in those days?
Yes, it was.
Early 50s, was it?
It was 50-51. 49-50-51.
And that was about the time when the Egyptians wanted to nationalise the canal, did they? Or they wanted to get south anyway?
They did, and especially towards the end of my time, when incidents began to... You know, it wasn't really very pleasant going off on your own anywhere. I mean, you didn't... I don't think we... I mean, people wore civilian clothes off-duty in the canal zone itself, and you would obviously wear plain clothes going up to Cairo, if you were going to Cairo for some reason, or Alexandria. But the gypos were getting very anti us. Mind you, I always thought we treated them terribly badly, terribly arrogantly, looking back on it.
But it was all part and parcel of the language in those days. I mean,
yes.
Back in England, you know, they were always referred to as the wogs.
Yes, I know, which... I'm absolutely against that, you see, having commanded an Arab force and so on. I love the Arabs. Looking back on it, I think we were terribly harsh to the Egyptians, and we could have had them on our side far more than we did. I mean, I had a friend out there, I'll give you an idea, the sort of thing that happened. He went away, he was a captain in the RASC called Mayo, and he came back looking very shaken from wherever he'd been, Ismailia or somewhere. And he said that a gang of yobbos got hold of him, put a rope round his neck, took him off to the Sweetwater Canal. It was quite obvious they were going to drown him. And he said, just by chance, a bloody good Egyptian police sergeant and six men came along and rescued him. But that sort of thing was happening. You were getting stones, boulders flung at you when you were driving along.
A bit like Palestine all over again.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
What, I mean... Could the situation have been renegotiated politically?
Yeah, I
think... It all revolved around the ownership of the canal, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And we sat pat on our rights as shareholders.
Yes.
And expected the Egyptians to swallow that all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think there could have been some...
I think...
Nationalisation on equitable terms?
The trouble is that, quite honestly, looking back on it, I was just a captain, and I wasn't sort of thinking of things like that. I was rather thinking what was happening around me at the time. But looking back on it, Anthony Eden was obviously paranoid about Nasser. I think Nasser could have been handled well by some people, undoubtedly, in the same way Glub Pasha wasn't handled as nicely as I'd like to have seen by King Hussein. But no doubt King Hussein had got influences being brought to bear on him. But I believe Nasser could have been made well disposed towards us, and I don't think the situation need ever have happened that did happen there.
Because it was still a very important strategic point.
It was.
Huge forces.
Yes, we did.
And one can understand, perhaps, politicians being very guarded on looking after political stability in the
area.
But of course that was the last thing he did. And of course when Eden sent the forces in on the Suez campaign, supposedly to keep the canal open, all it did was to get it blocked with
that, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It was a disaster, wasn't it? I think if we let our people go on and do what they've been told to do, I mean, you know, we could have occupied certainly the whole of the canal. And I don't think the Egyptians would have turned into guerrillas the way the Israelis would certainly have done. I don't think the Jebos would have. I don't think it's in their nature to do that. You know, they're not. I think they are brave when they're properly led, but I don't think they particularly want to fight any more than the Italians do.
But then that isn't the good long-term solution, is to take the canal back by force.
Yeah.
It's rather like the end of the Gulf War. Okay, you take Baghdad, how do you hold it?
Yes, quite, absolutely.
You've got a long-term political problem.
Well, of course you have.
Yeah. You've got a long-term political problem in Iraq now anyway.
Yes, I think they would have had to make up their mind, we're going to reoccupy the canal zone.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think...
Anyhow, you were there how long?
I was there for 2 years, and I left... I can't remember, honestly, I left in October 1951, and I know that Patricia and I, there were riots in Ismailia, and I got involved in them. I mentioned that in my book. I was on the staff there, though, but I got involved in the riots because I felt I should do at the time. There was, you know, something had to be done, and I felt I couldn't just sit and do nothing. And on our way to the boat at Port Said, for example, we were stoned going down there and cursed and yelled and all the rest of it. And then I went to Hong Kong from there. But I saw all the reoccupation of Ismailia. I saw a little bit of fighting there as well, the Lancashire Fusiliers. I didn't mention in my book.
Sorry, which time was this?
This was in 1951.
Oh, yes.
The Lancashire Fusiliers were one of the regiments that came into Ismailia from Fayed. And I personally led a platoon of them down to where there was a big incident happening. And they bloody well shot some Egyptians then, no doubt about it. And they deserved to be shot for what they were doing, you know.
What were they doing, sort of?
They were burning places, turning cars over, burning them, and terrifying all the local people. They were just yobbos from Cairo.
As opposed to the organized terrorist gangs, Jewish terrorist gangs.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Who were a much bigger menace.
Oh, much more, yes.
Much more.
These are just people, you know, giving vent to their hatred of the British, quite frankly.
You went up to Cairo on leave, okay?
Yes.
Did you?
Well, I only went up to Cairo to collect Patricia when she flew out with my two boys.
So you didn't go up there regularly for weekends?
No, never.
Is it mainly because you were not popular?
No, not at all. No, I'm terribly keen on games and so on, and I used to... I was always so busy. I was either playing hockey or I was playing water polo, or I was swimming or, competitively or sailing or... You know, I was so bloody busy playing tennis, squash. There was everything there. I had no wish to go to Cairo. I'd been a boy in Cairo. I knew Cairo. It wasn't anything particularly new to me. But also, I felt it was my job when my soldiers were playing games that I should, if I wasn't playing with them, that I was there to support them. And we found so much to do. We had a very good officers club from the social side. And what, there was shooting there as well. No, it was there was no draw to go to Cairo. I just went there, take Tish off the aeroplane with our little boys and bring them back again. No, the only time we went away, we went to Cyprus on leave.
Yeah. While we're on the subject, you know, you mentioned that you would go along to regimental or sports occasions.
Yeah.
To support them. Now, this... overword used, esprit de corps.
Yeah.
It strikes me, I mean, obviously you've come across it where it hasn't worked, where commanders have not got the gift of responding to their men and cementing a good working relationship.
Yeah.
Now this happens just as much in civilian life, where you've got good companies and bad companies.
Yes.
I mean, I've known, for instance, in my job as a film director, we'd go off around the world on a shoot with half a dozen blokes. And there are some directors, very good friends of mine, that were hopeless man managers. For instance, they'd arrive in a tower. The director would go in the better hotel, he'd go in the 5-star and leave his crew in the 3-star. And expect them all to knuckle under and work and everything else.
Yeah.
But that's the civilian thing. Even on my short R&BR trips, I knew when I was on a happy ship and on an unhappy ship.
Yes, yeah.
And it always, does my heart good to see teams working well together.
Yes, I quite agree, same here.
And I can sense a great thing among army people, and I can sense it from your book, how tremendous satisfaction in your work.
Yes.
To find you've got this rapprochement.
Yes.
And respect going in both directions.
Yes, absolutely. It is both directions.
Mm. And I can see this is one of the major fulfillments of your life coming up with this book. Mm-hmm. Why you've liked the army.
Yes.
Because you've had this. I mean, you're put in very trying conditions and you survive by virtue of the groundwork you've done and the interaction of good personalities and good NCOs.
I feel I've been so incredibly lucky with the people I've served with in all three services. It is, as you rightly say, it's entirely a two-way thing. I mean, your men are loyal to you, you're loyal to your men, and you never ask them to do anything that you are not prepared to do. Are capable of doing yourself, and you try to do it better than they do if it comes to that. And you don't expect them to live like pigs while you live, Having said that, of course, you've got to admit that there is an officer's mess, there's a sergeant's mess, and then the chaps have their naffies, and nowadays corporal clubs. So the officer does live better than the sergeant, and the sergeant lives better than the corporal, and the corporal lives better than the rifleman. But not to the extent. I mean, that in a way, there has to be a separation, otherwise a discipline definitely suffers. On the other hand, when you're on an exercise or on an operation, there's no question of officers living in a mess, and certainly in any unit I'm in, you all share exactly the same conditions, whatever they are, same food, same sleeping conditions. Everything utterly the same. And then in that way, you know bloody well, you've got a clear conscience. I mean, you're not sleeping under a down mattress or something, and your soldier's lying out under a ground sheet. You're all exactly the same.
And you also, there's much more of a levelling mechanism when you're living off nature. I mean, even to the extent that you've got to perform your bodily functions in the open.
That's right, yes.
Must knock any kind of dignity.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Mm. Now, you went on from the Canal Zone to Hong Kong.
Yes, I did, yeah. Mm.
And what was your job there?
I was commanding a company, a rifle company, as a major. Really our job was, we were stationed based on a place called Fanling, which is up near the border with China, and we were there really in case China invaded. And one of the first things we did, we put up enormous belt of wire right across the border, but we all knew bloody well that if the Chinese decided to come over, they'd come over millions of them, and we wouldn't have a hope, but we were told to put up the wire. And on Queen's birthday parade, we marched through Hong Kong so the people of Hong Kong knew that, if there were riots and so on, there were soldiers to back up the police. And really, after the Canal Zone, it was a very pleasant station in Hong Kong. I happened to like the Chinese enormously. And there was a tremendous amount to do there, but under very different circumstances. I mean, it was so civilized compared to Egypt, and it wasn't harsh and arid like Egypt. You've got this lovely, smiling, green countryside and beautiful shops for the girls to go into.
And did you have to control illegal border crossings? Or
No, the police were doing that. We were never asked to help. We did man little observation posts overlooking the border on certain occasions. When you saw the Chinese Communist Army on the other side, But we didn't. The actual stopping of the illegal immigrants was done by a huge border fence and the police.
And did you have any liaison at all with the Chinese commander across? Did you meet him?
No, not at all. Not then, no, not at all, no.
As you sort of moved up the ranks,
yes,
became responsible for larger and larger organizations,
yeah,
presumably you started to reach the political interface, the political-military interface.
Yes.
Were there occasions when you had to bite your tongue and say, that's a bloody stupid decision, but I've got to do my duty? Were you reaching that area now?
Not at that stage, I wasn't, no. I mean, no, not in Hong Kong. No, I didn't really reach that stage. I mean, even in when I was commanding my battalion, I don't remember ever feeling, probably because I had such a bloody marvellous general in Borneo, I never remember feeling, I had very good commanders in Germany as well, I don't remember that feeling until I got to Oman.
And then you were virtually a sort of commander on the ground there.
Yes, yeah, and there were political pressures then.
And you were in touch with the Foreign Office to keep...
Well, really, through the Consul General, as he was at the time, I sometimes got some rather... Not often, I once or twice got some stupider.
Yeah. Now, after Hong Kong, you came back to the Territorials, did you?
That's right, yes.
To the Duke of York's Barracks.
Yes, that's right. I was the training major of the London Irish Rifles, which meant, really, that I commanded them when the TA colonel wasn't there, and then once he came and the TA second in command and so on, I was there really as a professional advisor, and I had a regular adjutant and I had a regular quartermaster and I had a regular permanent staff instructor with each of the companies.
So was that a very civilised posting in the sense that you lived in London, I suppose?
Yeah, we had a quarter in Wandsworth. Mm-hmm. I can't say that, I mean, I love the London Irish, they're great, they're tremendous spirit. I was longing to get back to active soldiering even as soon as I got there almost. But they were a wonderful lot, and I like to think one was able to help them a lot. I used to run sand table exercises for them and cloth model exercises with my excellent adjutant. And then I also took a great interest in their sport, and every Saturday I was somewhere supporting a football match or running cross country for them or boxing for them, or, you know.
Were the lessons that you'd learned, particularly in Palestine, the Canal Zone, if you like, counterinsurgency, if you could call it that, was that fed back into your TA syllabus? Or
no.
They were trained...
They were a straightforward infantry battalion for a European war.
And there would be the annual camp?
Yes.
Salisbury Plain or somewhere?
They generally had it, yes. Either, I'm trying to think where we did go.
Or the Stamford Battle Area or something?
Yes, that sort of thing. Mm. But we used to give them a weekend off, you know, where they could go and enjoy themselves. I mean, they went to camp as a jolly, but we did work them bloody hard when they didn't have their weekend.
And presumably, the long-term strategic view of TA training was that you'd reach them, you'd get them to a certain level of capability.
Yes.
And then if an emergency came and they were called up, they'd obviously have just a finalised course to make full-time soldiers.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. We were awfully lucky. We had a number of wartime soldiers, even then in 1954. We'd still got a lot of wartime soldiers, and we had national servicemen, poor buggers, who had to come and do a statutory number of drills and weekends, and they had to come to annual camp, and they'd had the army by then. They did not want to come back, and so it was very much up to us to make sure they did enjoy the training as much as possible.
Well, I went to one TA camp. I was London District Signals for a
the summer
of 1950.
Yeah.
And I was sent up for a fortnight. I don't know which TA battalion it was, but it was from the Duke of York's Barracks. And it was one almighty piss-up.
Well, it sounds it could have been the London
the
Irish.
The colonel had a 1,500-weight truck full of crates of beer.
God.
And they never stopped drinking, as far as I can see. It was, that's an exaggeration. They achieved something, but all I did was ride round the back of a 1,500-weight 19-6.
There was an awful lot of drinking in those days.
Yeah.
There really was. In fact, it was awful as a regular, because you'd go, all the officers would go on a weekend, TA weekend, and they'd go into a pub. And the thing was that I was bloody badly off. I mean, I only had my pay. And you'd find that you had to pay a round of 18 drinks or something, you know. Mm.